Gene Shepherd, author, raconteur, and commentator on the contemporary scene. Here's Gene.
Test, hello, yeah, that's it. There, sneaking in there. Wow, what game? Hello, test. That's called speech compression. Tonight we've taken as our text, salute to the ding-dongs of the world. The lollygaggles of the world. How do you like that phrase? Lollygaggle is out of the early 18th and late 19th centuries. A lollygaggle is a dingbat, right? There's always been a word for it, you know. Oh, yes. The word changes, but the dingbat remains forever with us. You can call him whatever you want. He's old Slobus. Slobus humanus. Homo Slobus. The dingbats of the world. And, of course, now there's been a new development in dingbatism. And, we're putting this down. We'll be recording this for posterity in addition to broadcasting. This is a 1,000 years from now when they dig up the tapes. They'll know a little about what it really... See, this is the stuff you don't read in the Times. And unfortunately, if 1,000 years from now you were trying to reconstruct life in the 20th century from reading the Times, I think you'd have a little trouble reconstructing life. You'd construct a lot of political things. You'd construct... But not life, you know. Not life as it's lived out there on Route 3. It's a whole different ball game, right? Dingbat, right? Of course. Oh, yeah. Well, I've always felt that history is remiss in that anyway, you know. Whenever you read about the Roman Empire, you always read about various Caesars, and you read about various emperors and one thing. But you don't read about the guy that came along every day and swept the leaves off the roof of, the villa that Nero occupied outside of Pompeii during the summer. You don't know much about his life, what he ate, or anything else, you know. But he was there. He was there. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. When Nero was up there in the top row there, occupying the emperor's box at the Colosseum, and yelling and cheering like everybody else is out there, you know, putting his thumb up or putting his thumb down, outside of the Colosseum, because he could not afford a ticket, was Slobus Romanus, Italianus. And he was walking around there, you know, doing his thing, eating peanuts and hearing from a distance the cheers of the multitude. Not really the multitude, the cheers of the aristocracy. It's like... A Slobus Americanus New Yorkus can hardly get himself a ticket to, say, the New York Jets. Or even more than that, let's say the Knicks. Certainly he has trouble getting a ticket to almost anything that anything is good. But George Plimpton seems to have no trouble. Candace Bergen is at ringside. But the Slobus Americanus New Yorkus, he's out there walking around 6th Avenue kicking cigar butts. And from the long distance, he hears the cheers. And that's about it. But nobody records his life. His life. We record Philip Roth's life at great length and Norman Mailer's life, or even Yossarian of Catch-22. But nobody records the private who was in the same airplane with Yossarian. Remember, Yossarian was a captain, friends. A very salient point to remember. He was not every man. A captain is not every man. Anyone who's ever been in any of the armed forces knows that the captain is not every man. He is a captain. You know what they mean, captains of industry? That's not the same as working on the assembly line. And a captain in the armed forces is not working on the assembly line. And so the problem of putting dingbatism down, it's always a thankless task. Always. Remember that for the recorder of dingbatism. Or Slobusism, because he too will be ignored then by the very nature of recording the unrecordable. You're not going to get Anatole Breuillard to let's say, to seriously review In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. Because, first of all, he couldn't probably read it. It contains language that just goes beyond the language of, say, let's say, for argument's sake, Bruce Catton, or, other official writers of the time. So here we are, we're living in the midst of one world, and the other world is being recorded infinitely. But the other world is tiny. The world of Muhammad Ali and Joe Garagiola is tiny compared to the world that is lived by the average walking around, sniffing, gum-chewing citizen of the realm. Have you noticed now that gum has... That's a new, by the way, a new trend, which you are going to hear right here for the first time. A few years from now, New York will write about it. Have you noticed the new fat gums that have suddenly hit the market? What? You mean you don't know? Well, you're going to learn for the first time. Why, there's a gum now called Big Red that is part of the great tradition of the American West. It was spawned by the tradition of the Westerners who went out and conquered the mountains and the rivers of the Great West. Big Red. Bum, ba-dum, bum, right? I kind of like that. And, of course, then there have to be a gum that will capture either a gum or it'll be a possibly a fudgesicle that will recapture the spirit of the founding fathers. And it'll come with a little silver wig on it, maybe, you know, made of polyethylene. And I can just see the commercials for it. It says, you've admired Patrick Henry when he said, give me liberty or give me death. If Patrick Henry had been alive today, he would have enjoyed the Founding Father Popsicle, which says, give me liberty or give me a Founding Father Popsicle. That's what America's all about. La da da dee 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 dee. Big Red, you're riding off into the sunset a-chewing your gum. Luke, just a-chewing. And, of course, this is all part of this is all part of our time. You can't ignore it. See, and that's my function as an artist, see, to record these unrecordable bits, which are not trivia. Oh, no. No, they bespeak great things about us. We are living in the age of now. No longer is nostalgia a peripheral issue. It is a central issue to life. A central issue to life. On the one hand, you have vast voters who are intrigued by a guy who obviously was a good guy in the movies. But old movies. See, that's important. Old movies. And on the other hand, a guy that grows peanuts on the land. On the land. You hear that? On the land, folks. Yeah, I'm just a simple country boy. And I just say that we ought to bring some simple country boy virtues to our land. And so this is all part of the vast central core of nostalgia that's running through American life. And I say also, too, have you noticed, I think a lot of politicians are ignoring one basic factor of the politicians that are involved today. I'm not, incidentally, one of the most predictable of all columns. Every year, there is a column written by one or at least sometimes 10 national columnists to say one. There are no candidates running this year who are worthy of even a vote. That's as predictable as the fact that the leaves are going to fall off the trees in the fall. That column is always written. And it was written when Kennedy ran. Of course, he's deified now, but it was written when Kennedy ran. And I can even quote the writer who wrote it. And one major commentator said this on the news the night before Kennedy's election. He said, I personally am not going to vote. Both these candidates are, they're so alike, they were both created by the ad agencies. Who was that? He is still considered a deep thinker on the network. His name, by the way, his initials are E.S. Bum, bum, ba-da-da, dee, 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 dee. So, this is, but wait a minute, this is all part of the time. So, I'm not putting any of it down. And I say, another column that is always being written is, the primary system is ridiculous, it must go. Hey, you always say that. Replaced by what? Well, a national system of primaries. They don't want that.
Do you realize if we had one day for a national, why, do you realize that for at least 6 months out of every election year, the news departments would have nothing to write about? Why, do you realize more expense accounts flourish and blossom? And there's more beautiful travel time logged by more correspondents during the time that the primaries are going, than any other time. I don't want to get rid of that. See, it's the love-hate thing, you know, if you get rid of that. Oh, yes, everybody gets up and puts down. It's like an actor that puts down the Oscars, you know, but just once leave him off the list. Bum, ba-dum, bum. So, man is man, you know, he's man. And here we are, you know, sitting here in the middle of a great central core of nostalgia that went through. By the way, I might also add, we're not the first country that went through the central core of nostalgia. Well, no, England. England for years. Yes, you don't know of England then. If you bespeak your ignorance of England if you do not know that running through much of English life for the past 40 years was a great desire to return, curiously enough, to the 30s. Now you say, how, why? Well, even on the part of the labor movement in England. The labor movement in England still likes to believe that it is living in an embattled breadline. So hence, get all you can! That's a kind of nostalgia, too. You see it running through life in New York. Oh, yes. I heard a faculty member the other day in a major university around here. I was sitting at the lunch table with him. And he says, everyone knows that the college professor is one of the truly economically deprived members of society. I noticed one thing, though. He drove up to the evening's entertainment in his 280 SE. And he also then spent a great deal of time telling me about his home on Cape Cod, which he enjoys 3 months out of the year. But so he was living in nostalgia. He was living back in the days when the simple little school teacher was paid by the people around him, by the community, in potatoes, and they'd fix his shoes once in a while. So that's part of nostalgia. You can have nostalgia that doesn't relate to old movie stars. If for example, I one time went to an award ceremony where the award ceremony was being presented. It was a newsman or as a ceremony, and they like to think of themselves as underpaid, ink-stained wretches. You know, right, a Dickensian, ink-stained wretch. Ink-stained wretch. Woodward and Bernstein, ink-stained wretches. Why, they're in big business, friend. Whenever Robert Redford buys the rights to your work, you're in big business, man. And it was one of those guys that made that statement. So, which way does the wind blow? The wind blows whichever way you want it to blow. La da da ti 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 ti. So I returned, from a vast trip around the great unrecorded bowl of the Midwest. Unrecorded, and that's an official, non-official place. You cannot write an official novel about the Midwest. And you're going to say, why? Can you name one recently? That's right. But there have been many written. Because that's not an official part of the country, literally speaking. Many writers have come from there, but they had to come from there and cleverly disguise themselves as New Yorker editorialists like James Thurber to get accepted. Mark Twain had to move to Connecticut, you know. Now, on the other hand, the South is an official part of the country to write about. But it has to be written the right way, decadent. Blanche DuBois has to rock on the front porch of every home south of the Mason-Dixon line. And the old darkies have to be out there singing in the corn and the cotton fields to be an official book about the South. Either that, or the West is getting to be official. That's called the Larry McMurtry symbol. I'm leaving Cheyenne to come to the big town. All right. Listen, I have to go on further. If you've never traveled, and I'm going to do a little traveling here for you. If you've never really traveled up in that very historic part of the country, historic in a specific way, the upper peninsula of Michigan, the upper that vast brooding. You know, there's a brooding quality in what they call the North Woods section of Wisconsin. And I don't mean brooding just because of the woods, but there is a curious brooding quality. You know, when you travel across Wisconsin, you're traveling across a state that is probably as schizoid as any state in the Union. And that's why they send so many strange people to Congress, like the late Senator Joseph McCarthy. And they go on both sides of the political scale. Fantastic. Split in between one group and the other group in that state. On the one hand, the university community is still fighting Vietnam. This is where, whenever any time a candidate arrives on any campus on the University of Wisconsin, they do unspeakable things to them. That's part of that curious split. You know, you tend to think of Wisconsin as being one of those simple, wonderful states where they walk around and make cheese. Well, I've always felt, and I want to go on record as saying it here, I always felt that most of us, in our own head, are the victims, and I mean victims, of a numberless catalog of meaningless, unintelligent cliches. In other words, the firm belief that most New Yorkers have that out there is Doris Day land, is one of the great cliches, just as the city guy is often misunderstood by people, say, in towns like, just for argument's sake, if you were to go to a town like Camden, Minnesota, which is a little town, and you'd ask them about New York, well, they have all kinds of strange, cloudy ideas of what a New Yorker is like. And your ideas of what a town like, you know, a state like Wisconsin is equally cloudy, and by the way, equally dangerous politically. And so, it's assumed by the Easterner that the conservatives come from the Midwest, in spite of all evidence to the contrary. You don't call Birch Bayh, for example, a conservative. Was Adlai Stevenson a conservative? All right. Was Joe McCarthy a conservative? Oh, no. One should not confuse, Joe McCarthy with Robert Taft, who was a conservative. In other words, a conservative is not a right-wing rabble-rouser. See, you see the problem here in America. We're beginning to louse up our own terms. So we tend to think that anybody who is on the right side of a picture is a conservative. Anybody. That's like saying that anybody on the left side of a picture, of the political picture, is a communist. It's not so. And so you, Wisconsin has sent one or the other kind of wild activist to Congress. Well, what do you think the current one is? The guy that is now currently in trouble. What's his name? The one that had the hair transplant. Come on. Proxmire. Well, he's a typical Wisconsin. See, he's a hellfire. Let's reform the world type. And this comes, a lot of these come out of Wisconsin. They want to reform the world either right or left, but they want to reform it. And they have a tendency to be very, very didactic. And more than that, they're dedicated aesthetics. They're aesthetes. And so they dedicate their entire career to running all day long and forswearing all bad language. Wisconsin's a curious state. And you get a sense of that broodingness because when you leave Wisconsin, you know, you drive south from the upper part of the peninsula, way up in the northern part of Wisconsin. I don't know of any state, really, that is more drastically different on the south part of its borders than it is on the north. Now, you probably don't know that. Wisconsin on the far north is a state of, in a very real way, lone woodsman. It's a mean, bitter climate. And by the way, bitter climates have always bred people who want to reform the world. They've come out of a kind of adversity. Martin Luther lived in the cold fastnesses of the mountain German world, and they simply don't come from nice, soft, easy places like the Riviera. You just can't imagine a solved all problems type coming from, say, a town like DeLand, Florida. Well, why you smile at that? Because you're seriously, secretly recognizing the fact that the people who come from these barren, rocky places often are the ones who want to straighten up the rest of the world. Have you ever seen the films of Bergman? They drip with despair. And yet, this is supposed to be a paradise, you know, Sweden. It drips with despair. And he speaks for many Swedes. There is a kind of brooding despair in them. And you find a great deal of that in Wisconsin. The same kind of curious, northern, self-searching, brooding quality. And as you drive south out of say, places like Eagle River, what am I talking about? Well, there are places like Eagle River, Rhinelander. You drive through a little town like Rhinelander, and you can palpably feel in the air a curious kind of brooding quality. By the way, they have the greatest A.W. root beer stand I ever saw in my life in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. And they used the European style in this one. Can you imagine? In Rhinelander, Wisconsin, they got an A&W. It's a beautiful restaurant. You go in, see, inside. And all the girls are dressed wearing funny little A&W baseball caps. And they're very, very neatly uniformed. And you don't order there the way you order. You pick up a phone. There's a phone at your desk. You pick it up. And the girl calls you back then. Your phone rings. And you give them the order. And there's a curious bitter quality, and the wind blows out of the north. And then as you drive south in this state, you see a whole different world. Great, lush Wisconsin farms. And there is a very curious mixture of people out in Wisconsin. For example, it's one of the great Polish states of the nation. And practically every store in Wisconsin, as you just go into a supermarket, they sell fifth. Just like here in the New York area, when you go into a supermarket, they have an entire department that says Italian foods, right? Well, if you go into a store in certain parts, large parts of Wisconsin, they have an entire section devoted to Polish and German food, period. Just like we have Italian here, they have German. So you see all these Polish sausages all lined up in the meat department. All these, to a New Yorker, exotic, enigmatic foods, which are part of the Polish, Germanic background that they have. Sauerkraut, by the way, is the Wisconsin pizza. And their drink is beer. Now, it's no coincidence that they make beer in Wisconsin because great numbers of German brewmeisters emigrated to that state down around the turn of the century. And it was a state very much like their Germany, you see. This is why they came there. It looked familiar to them. It had brisk, short, cool summers. Germany has this. It has the brooding woods, which Germany has. There is the... And what, by the way, what beer is the most popular beer in Wisconsin? You see it everywhere. It is not one you know. I'll give you the clue. It is not Schlitz or Pabst or the ones that you know that are made in Wisconsin, but it is a beer called Hams, H-A-M-M-S, which is the beer that... Everywhere you go, you see this big signs, Hams beer. And But beer is the lifeblood of the state, one part of the state. So on one hand, you have a state on the southern part of the state where beer, they drink beer, they dance the polkas, and they do the whole, you know, they go the whole way. The far northern part of the state is abstemious. This is the Proxmire part of the state, where they do not drink, they do not do any of this thing, and they spend a great deal of their time going to various very fundamental churches, Lutheran. And so you get this great split in the state. And one or the other of the factions is always in the ascendancy or descendancy. So on the one hand, you may get a great left-wing character come out of the state. And on the other hand, you may get a right-wing character. But you rarely get a middle-of-the-roader out of Wisconsin. It's a wild state. And for those of you who don't know much about the state, it's an intriguing place. Incidentally, Wisconsin is also known for giving, in the earliest days of its life, giving America some of its great comics. Who came from there? Herb Schreiner, are you kidding? Herb Schreiner came from Ohio. Contrary to the popular opinion that he came from Indiana, he tailed Indiana jokes, but he was from Ohio. I tell you, this is coming from Indiana. He was a $3 bill Indianan. Who are some of the great ones? Jack Benny, of course, and who else? Well, there have been several great comics come out of that state. And incidentally, there's a theory that comedy comes out of a schizoid condition in your life around you. That doesn't mean you're a schizoid. It means the world that you see is a world of contrasts. And so you think that way. And so Wisconsin is a fantastically interesting, I find it an intriguing state. And up in the far reaches of Wisconsin is where all the gangsters, by the way, went on their vacations. This is where Dillinger shot it out. And by the way, the local authorities did not cooperate. Not that they were for Dillinger, but they see themselves as an entity of themselves. Who are you to come here and do this work, is the belief. And then when you cross over to Minnesota, it's a totally different kind of state. If you think that Minnesota is Mary Tyler Moore'sville, no. That's just the opening. It has nothing to do with Ted Knight. There's another fantastically interesting, to me, an intriguing state. And it's probably, I would say Minnesota, and this is a personal estimation, Minnesota is probably the most beautiful state in the Union. Yes, really. And I mean it, really. I mean for continual, unrelieved magnificence of land. Great, fantastic beauty. Now, we always think of beauty as dramatic. Mountains, that's beauty. And yet, if you go to Colorado, vast parts of Colorado are brown, totally uninteresting. The mountains are there, but that's it. But this state of Minnesota just rolls on and on and on. Great, long, vast horizons. The most fantastic farms in the world are in Minnesota. And the earth in Minnesota is the color of black, indelible ink. I mean, they say that if you're driving too slow and you throw your popcorn box out in the field, 20 minutes later, there's a field of popcorn. It's just absolutely, and the land is so, to buy this land, you know, to become a Minnesota farmer, the land itself is worth today something like $2,000 to $3,000 an acre. And can you imagine a guy with a 400-acre farm out there? There's no way for you to decide to become a Minnesota farmer now. It's hereditary. And the only way that it's happened is maybe three or four generations on one farm. But if you decided to go out and buy a farm today in Minnesota, you'd have to have probably a paying farm. You'd have to have at least $1 million capital to start with. This is truly some state. And then going down to the long western slopes of Minnesota, right where it just touches up against South Dakota. You always think of Minnesota's Midwest and all. And those great flat western rivers lying there.
You've been listening to Gene Shepherd, author, raconteur, and commentator on a contemporary scene.